What are a couple of things that you would point to that you felt you accomplished for yourself, for your riding, during this term that you've had in Parliament? What's a couple of things you're proudest of?
Representing my constituents is actually very rewarding on another level that maybe doesn't make the news. But in the constituency offices, you know, you get the phone calls of helping somebody with the tax issue, and the guy had $24,000 in a bill to CRA, and we managed to work through it where it was wiped from his account because it was a series of errors, I guess. Those kind of things are incredibly rewarding because you know you've just helped somebody's result of just a little bit of help from us.
So it's not always about cutting the ribbon and handing out the oversized check.
No, I was never a photo op guy anyway, and it's something I've had to learn to do because people are saying, look, we need a photo of you here. So I've gotten used to that, I guess, and make sure that we do that. But in terms of rewarding in Ottawa, too, it's getting a lot of infrastructure. We just got $110 million.
What's that going towards?
True infrastructure, roads and bridges and things that we need, passing lanes up to Fort Nelson and different things, especially in areas that are, you know, there's been some fatalities up there, unfortunately. We want to make sure that that's lessened. I want to make sure that people get home to their families at the end of a workday. So that kind of stuff's rewarding, too. They're actually the projects people want on the ground, not just something that we can come up with in Ottawa.
I want to shift to healthcare briefly because the NDP leader has come out in favor of hiring 7,000 more doctors and getting more doctors into the system.
Yep.
But as I'm sure you must be aware of, in Fort St. John, recruiting a doctor is tougher than it sounds.
Right.
Not a lot of doctors, at first blush, because they may not know anything about the place, want to come to Northern BC. Mm. What do you think you'd be committed to doing? What do you think the next Conservative government would be committed to doing to adding more doctors or at least incentivizing doctors to come to Northern BC and stay here?
100% behind that. We've actually already been working with the healthcare coalition up there with Pat Pym, and they're just trying to find out the reasons why we can't get doctors up in Fort St. John and why they're drifting away. And if we could add that many doctors, that would be absolutely awesome. I think incentivizing them, we've tried incentives like loan forgiveness and student loans and that kind of thing, but it still hasn't been enough to draw that person from Vancouver, Ontario, up to Northern BC. We have a lot of great South African doctors, and I have one myself. He's been absolutely awesome. He's a good friend. And just to make sure that that pathway is still open to Canada from South Africa, and it still is. So we got that reopened again. And we just need to make sure, what are the issues? What are they? Get them ironed out so we can get doctors for the North.
Resource-based communities tend to be a bit boom and bust. How do you go about making sure that this stabilizes somehow, that there is less of that boom and bust in these resource communities?
Yeah. We're seeing a holding pattern, I would suggest, waiting for some of these, the LNG project to have its environmental process finally decided. Mm-hmm. And some of those mining jobs, especially these people, transition into better jobs. And world prices dictate whether coal is going to sell or whether it's not going to sell, or copper or whatever the commodity is. I would say as much as we can diversify in northern communities, we will. And that's why we work on free trade agreements around the world to make sure that if one sector is struggling, like mining, for instance, that forestry will pick up the slack and be able to be a good transition for those workers, or in the LNG field or in oil. So people have other options when one closes.
Pipelines and energy resources and developing those energy resources. It seems to me in the last couple of years is that where the government and the people proposing different pipeline projects, where they've taken a hit is on social license.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people feel like the government either isn't listening or isn't consulting appropriately, seems to want to just ram these projects through. What do you think your government needs to do to improve that relationship, or at least to listen more and take more feedback?
Well, for one thing, governments don't build pipelines, so we don't ram through anything. It's pipeline proponents that would propose a project, and all we're asked to do is do environmental assessments on those projects, like, for instance, the Enbridge project. And it was approved with 209 conditions, and they're not just simple little conditions. They're very rigorous conditions, so hardly our project slam dunk. There's been a mine that hasn't gone through as a result of some environmental concerns that have come before us, and the environment minister said that she was concerned about it, and that's why it didn't go through. The LNG project is going through right now, and that's why it's been delayed. It's been asked by local First Nations that they want to have some more rigor put, and the NEB has responded and said, yes, we'll do that, and this is the way it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Zimmer, Friday morning, the news broke that the Lac Wallams will be announcing a an Aboriginal title claim to Leelo Island and Flora Bank. And, of course, that's the site of a proposed LNG terminal. Mm-hmm. Certainly, that's not your riding, but it certainly will affect your riding mm-hmm. because of where that LNG is going to be coming from. What's your reaction to the Lac-Walams coming forward and launching this title claim now?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I know that the proponent and Petronas and Progress and the group have, what I've seen, have been very diligent trying to work with First Nations around the pipeline, and I know they have a lot of support. I know First Nations that are supportive in my area, so we'll see what happens, I guess, mm-hmm. with the claim and go from there.
Where are we in terms of that discussion about developing more economic partnerships with Canadian First Nations and First Nations across yeah. northern BC? Because it seems like, you know, it was highlighted the other night in the Globe debate how little discussion there was around Aboriginal issues
yeah.
as it relates to the economy. It seems like there are certain First Nations that want to be part of that mm-hmm. economic engine, others less so.
Yeah.
Where do you think that conversation can go?
I'll give you an example. I was just out at the Stewart opening, and the president of NISHCA was there, and Ted Pickle is the guy that built the port. And I used to work for him as a teenager. It's a simple agreement between two people to see that that port was done. It was really good to see because it was benefiting both groups. In terms of promise for First Nations and reserves and all the rest of it, I think the benefit is there with prosperity and long-term prosperity for people that have jobs for the rest of their lives. They don't need to worry about where their next meal comes from necessarily, but actually have a good life with a nice house and the rest of it that the rest of us can enjoy at times. Mm-hmm. I think once that prosperity and just a good life is understood and realized, as most First Nations, I believe, in my area, northeastern BC, do already, once that's fully realized and understood, I think they'll work better together. But again, that's the proponent's job to have certain discussions. Certain proponents do better at it than others. And I think the challenge is proponents need to learn how to talk to First Nations and have a respectful conversation of two leaders meeting across the table. And I know that was the example at Stewart Port. It was two leaders coming together and made a decision and shook hands. And then they said to the lawyers, okay, now work it out. It wasn't the other way around. Yeah. So that's where I think we need to keep going and make sure there's a mutual respect there from proponent to Aboriginal peoples. And I think we'll go far.
I want to shift our focus to Bill C-51.
Mm.
There's been some sharp contrast between the introduction of Bill C-51 and the collection of information on Canadians to oppose and counteract terrorism. What was essentially one of the big things that brought the Conservatives to power in the first place, and that's the Long Gun Registry.
Mm.
And much of what the opposition that I believe the Conservatives brought to the table on the Long Gun Registry is that perfectly innocent Canadians
right.
shouldn't have to feel like criminals for owning a gun.
Right.
Why should perfectly innocent Canadians have to feel like criminals for having their information collected?
They won't. I've read the bill several times, and I think one of the misconceptions of the bill is that it's going to be this overarching police state kind of looking at everybody's information. But in order for a security force, like let's say the RCMP or any group, to actually dig into somebody's private and confidential information, there has to be a reason why to precipitate further investigation. So, for example, if somebody's recruiting ISIL as terrorists for Canadian purposes or wherever, mm-hmm. That's discovered by one of the security groups in Canada, then before any further investigation and digging into somebody's personal files is done, they have to go before a judge and ask, based on this evidence, we would like to do further investigation. And then whether the judge decides whether that's warranted or not, it's up to the judge to decide. So it isn't this blanketing of looking at everybody's information. It's looking at just cause cases only. Those cases will be dug into further, and that's what the legislation says.
I think the sense, though, that most people have mm-hmm. with the legislation is that it's everyone's worst fears. It is the fear of the police state. How can this stuff be done without making people feel like their own personal freedom is being infringed upon?
We set up in the actual document a lot of safeguards. And again, the judge, it wasn't just going to be a legislator that was going to decide who's going to be investigated. That's why there's a judge based on mm-hmm. some evidence. So October 22nd, I was there. I was in the room. And one thing we saw as a result of that were the silos of security in Canada. We saw the RCMP in a different silo than the Ottawa police, and Ontario police are all in separate silos. And I remember after that, the prime minister being committed to seeing those silos come down, so at least the security forces could talk to each other about legitimate reasons, mm-hmm. right? I know that's the way it's been sort of sold by different groups and that, but and I've been challenged too on my social media about this too, and I've said, look, just look at the legislation. I've read it myself several times. Let me know what specifically you want, and I can dig yeah. into that and maybe calm some of the fears and explain some of it away. Okay. Again, the judge is a key part of the whole piece, so that's why we think it's not as bad as people think.
Bob Zuber, thank you for your copious amount of time this morning.
Thank you. It was fun. Thanks.